Good afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 10th, 2019, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on our show today, Artisphere 2019 launches tonight, and the annual Festival of Arts in the Earth has something for almost everybody, even Pluto. We'll have a partial rundown in our second half hour. After the show, on NPR's Here and Now, a discussion of a new Netflix series about the Central Park Five, five black teenagers wrongly convicted of rape and murder after they were coerced by police to confess. That's on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR, beginning after Ozarks at Large at 1 on 91.3. The Springdale Public Library hosts Multicultural Night tonight from 6 to 7. The event at the library is open to all families and will feature fun, dancing, and crafts. You can learn more about tonight and other events at the library at springdalelibrary.org or the Springdale Public Library Facebook page. Hope Humane Society Animal Shelter in Fort Smith is closing. The organization provided animal impoundment services for the city for a number of years. Hope Board Vice President Storm Nolan says the city's contract amounted to about $300,000 of the shelter's annual budget of $1 million. During contract renegotiations last month, the Humane Society requested the city pay $650,000 for their services, since most of the cats and dogs came from the Fort Smith Animal Control. Nolan says the city felt that was too high and decided to go in another direction. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Storm Nolan about the closure on Friday. They began by talking about how the end of that contract has had an impact on the shelter's ability to remain open.
We took out a $500,000 loan with Bancorp South in order to build a new building last year that would house more dogs. At the time, we were bursting at the seams and needed space. That loan comes due mid-July, July 17th, and without a sustainable financial model in place, the bank is not willing to refinance that. And so they've indicated that they would start foreclosure proceedings come July 18th or thereabouts.
So how many dogs and cats are left to be adopted out at this point?
Last time I checked, we were down to one kitten and 237 dogs, which is way, way down from our maximum within the high 300s. I think at this point we have all but 30 some odd pit mixes accounted for as far as homes pledged, most of which are going by transport. And so we've got just a bunch of adorable dogs that are completely adoptable and would make great pets, and about 39 of them. So if any of your listeners are in need of a new pet or have room for a new dog in their family, this is a great time to help these cute and adorable dogs, you know, find their forever home.
Can you tell us more about the transports? Because it sounds like that was one way to get a lot of the animals at the Hope Humane Society out before the facility shuts down.
People ask, how are you able to transport so many out? Where are they going? You know, how are there communities out there that can take so many dogs? And the thing is, in almost every part of the country but the Southeast, where communities have implemented mandatory spay-neuter, they've implemented pet registration, they do not have a problem with stray animal population. So we're partnering with shelters all over the country, and including some in Canada, southern Canada, where their communities have such a small problem with stray animals that they have way excess capacity at their shelters. And these communities are in such need of adoptable dogs that a lot of these dogs that we send over are pledged to an adoptive family before they even show up in the community. So it's really amazing, but it's encouraging that, you know, once we get that culture shift here and that leadership shift, you know, we can be like that, to where we're not having to talk about this. This is not a problem that we're having to spend time on, because because it's been addressed.
So the dogs left at the shelter are pit mixes. My understanding is they're just a little bit harder to transport out to other shelters.
So the pit mixes are harder. There are some communities out there where they're banned. But I can tell you personally, I have a pit mix that adopted us as a family, and it's been one of the best dogs we've had. You know, we don't adopt out animals that we feel are aggressive or too aggressive to live with a family.
The Hope Humane Society became a no-kill shelter about 2 years ago, and what a no-kill shelter means is that the shelter has a 90% or higher live release rate. Some in the city of Fort Smith contend that the city should have been consulted in that decision before the Hope Humane Society went in that direction. What's your response to that?
That decision is solely up to the Hope Humane Society board. Our board felt very strongly that pledging to become a no-kill shelter was the right ethical thing to do. And looking at other communities like Rogers, Arkansas, they have implemented just common sense animal control ordinances. In implementing those reforms since 2010, they have become a no-kill facility, and with over a 90% live release rate. In fact, it was in the high 90s last time I checked. So the point is, if our city were to have implemented common sense ordinances, it kind of rethought how the animal control officers worked as far as their goal of reuniting pets with the owners as opposed to getting them off the street and bringing them to shelter. No-kill should have happened naturally. And Rogers has proven that that can be done.
So now the city of Fort Smith obviously has to figure out what to do with its stray animals. They started that last week when the board of directors voted to allow city administrator Carl Gefgen to go ahead with evaluations of some potential animal control programs. One organization that presented at that meeting was Kitties and Canines. So what are your thoughts on the city's plans so far on how to tackle this?
So Ramona Roberts and the K&K Kitties and Canines board, they're great people. They run a really good operation. My understanding that they haven't reached a financial agreement yet with the city, which of course is where things started to fall apart for us. So hopefully K&K can fill that gap temporarily. My one concern is, I used Rogers as an example earlier. Rogers has an animal services department, and under that department is animal control, the officers, and the shelter. And it's run by one person, a director of animal services. And what that does, it creates a culture of, as I said before, let's get these dogs back to their owners. I'm hoping that this arrangement with K&K, or even if the city decides to build and operate their own shelter, I hope we can follow in footsteps of cities like Rogers that have done it really well, to where we're not resorting to euthanization as a solution.
The Hope Humane Society has been around since 1937. So, I mean, come July 17th, what happens to the organization? Does it cease existing along with the shelter?
Once we close down operations at our actual shelter, we hope to continue to be advocates for just common sense pet welfare in our community. And we'll continue to advocate for the proposed ordinances. We'll continue to advocate for animal control where the goal is to get the dog back to its owner. And of course, we will be eyes and ears looking at how the city handles their own sheltering, or even if it ends up being a Kitties and Canines, which we know that they're great operators and they're not going to resort to euthanizing adoptable dogs. But our bigger concern is if the city does take over sheltering, that they're doing it in a humane way.
Well, thank you for catching us up, and hopefully the organization survives in one way or another.
I appreciate that. No, thank you, Susanna.
That was Hope Humane Society Board Vice President Storm Nolan speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. The shelter will close July 17th, and they still have several dozen dogs left that can be adopted. Later on today's show, overcoming fear of the dentist.
Over time, people gradually realize that, you know, their dentist is really more than capable of making their visit comfortable and, in most cases, virtually pain-free.
Arkansas Public Media series on oral health in Arkansas continues in our second half hour.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Thaden School is accepting applications for grades 6 through 11 in the 2019-2020 academic year. The newly built campus is located in downtown Bentonville. Thaden educates students from across Northwest Arkansas. THADENschool.org for more information.
Pleasant Monday. This is Ozarks at Large. This summer, University of Arkansas officials are working to ensure students have access to free tampons when they return for the fall semester. Similar efforts are being made at colleges across the country, including the University of Washington and Princeton. The effort at the U of A is a result of the Menstrual Equality for All Act. James DiLoretto Hill is president of the Graduate Professional Student Congress, and he worked with the Associated Student Government to pass the legislation. Late last week, JD stopped by Studio 123 to talk with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about what inspired him to launch this initiative.
We were hosting a conference for the National Association of Graduate and Professional Students last November. Actually, I serve on their board. And so we hosted them at the U of A, and it's a vivid memory. I was standing outside in the hallway in the Union, and who's now a friend of mine, BJ, who's a Penn Law student, came out of the bathroom and said, "What is the deal with your tampon dispenser?" She's like, "There's literally three padlocks on there." And I just kind of looked at her and I said, "Well, I'm a gay man. I have really not encountered, this is just not an issue that I've had to encounter." And I was like, sitting there thinking about it, I'm like, "This is, that's kind of ridiculous though. I've never really thought about this." And so she said she was going to go back to Penn and try to work on getting it kind of acting her campus. And I said, "Well, I want to do that here." And so we kind of corresponded kind of through the board and, you know, with each other over the next few months. And then we kind of sat down and she worked with me in helping me kind of write up the bill. But the big thing is we just, you know, I more I talked to people, the more I kind of got that same reaction. It's like, you know, I've never thought about that, but this makes perfect sense. Why wouldn't we do that? We give toilet paper, we give paper towels, we give soap, and no one even thinks about that. Why is this an issue? You know, and then, of course, you get into first of all, you're forcing people to use coins in the dispenser. So you're charging them and making them use quarters. I don't remember the last time I had quarters in my pocket. And then do they even work? Are they stocked? And so there's all these questions that, you know, we started to get. And I said, yeah, this really makes sense. It's, you know, if we're going to care about inclusivity, then this is something that probably should have realistically happened decades ago, but it hasn't. So let's push forward with this. We wrote the bill. I went before Graduate Professional Student Congress. It was voted unanimously by the body. They were very enthusiastic. And right around the same time, I approached ASG and just said, I would love to partner with you guys on this. I'm not really going to focus too much on the details or the language. I just want you guys to, I would just love to do this together with you. Here's my language. Take from it what you want. Leave what you want. They decided to take the whole thing, pass it exactly verbatim. We then took that and sent it along with kind of a cover letter to the chancellor and then the vice chancellor for facilities management and just said, this is what we've passed. We'd really like to meet with you and start kind of seeing what we can do to get this process moving forward.
So what is some of that language that you presented to them? What are some of the things that you're wanting to see happen?
So
to
the,
make big, it
the biggest thing is that, you know, it's that the fact that if you're having your period and you can't access menstruation products, you're going to quite possibly miss class, miss a meeting, and that is creating inherently an unequal access to education. That is an issue that, you know, someone who's menstruating has to deal with and not males. And so, or at least biological males. And so they, that was pretty much it. We took some language a little bit from the United Nations, which has actually declared these products to be a human right. And that obviously, you know, they're looking at it in terms of third world countries and some of the more, you know, antiquated policies around the world. But it is kind of built off of that in Western countries like Australia. And I know the UK have looked at this exact same way and just been like, no, we need to pass this. This is something that really just needs to be done. You know, we were very cautious in the planning process too. We didn't want to be presumptive and try to prescribe how the university should do it in terms of details. Basically, you know, the way I put it to the facilities management was, I'm not an expert in running these facilities. This is literally, I mean, you're the expert in doing that. And so we want to kind of give you guys the room and the space to do this and not, you know, prescribe anything. Basically, all we care about is this gets done. And, you know, not that we have a few select locations around campus. That doesn't quite cut it. We want this in every bathroom. It's just like there's paper towels in every bathroom. And they were incredibly supportive. The dean of students in particular really pulled in a group of administrators from the Pat Walker Health Center, from facilities, from student affairs, from the chancellor's office, and basically created this kind of group of folks, and they decided to kind of get things off the ground. To facilities credit, you know, some of the research that I had done, there's a couple of nonprofits out there that will do this for both, you know, public and private institutions and businesses to kind of get their buildings with tampons, and they have some information on kind of how to roll this stuff out. One of the common things was to do a pilot program, you know, just to see, you know, what is the demand like? You know, are there areas in campus where demand is higher? And so that's really what I presented to them and more or less assumed that that's kind of what we would do maybe in the next semester, possibly the next full year. But they really one-upped us and said, no, we're going to go to every bathroom and we are going to change every dispenser. And this is free across campus in every bathroom that we have, which was phenomenal and, you know, unexpected and beyond obviously appreciated. So they really... really jumped on and were far more supportive than we would have even hoped. So it was really great, pleasantly surprised.
So you passed this bill in March?
That sounds about right, yep.
And then went and talked to them. And I know things can be kind of slow at the end of the semester, but it sounded like they jumped right on it.
Yep, so they did. We had a few kind of, probably took us about a month in some of the initial conversations where people were kind of like, oh, what is this? And trying to wrap their heads around it and to determine exactly what we wanted and to kind of make sure that all the expectations were kind of clear. But as soon as we really sussed that out and we basically just said what I, you know, how I just put it, that we're not really interested in the how. We're happy to help in any way we can, but we're not, you know, we just want you to do this and whatever is easiest. If you want us to assist and find, there are dispensers that they make. There's companies that can help you track the flow of things so you can see, you know, have a pilot program that is efficient. But as soon as they kind of did that, it was within a few weeks they had kind of started moving on things. And so basically what University Relations has asked us to do now is they've asked myself and some representatives from ASG to kind of come up with the marketing campaign, more or less. And so they're basically like, yes, we will handle all the logistics. You guys don't even have to worry about that. Why don't you guys come up with some slogans, some stickers, and so we can put them on all of these dispensers. So, you know, because this is unexpected, you know what I mean? When you go into a bathroom, you don't even anticipate these things are free. So we want to make sure that we can, you know, make that known and make it known that this is something that the University of Arkansas now values and, you know, this is how it's going to be moving forward.
Are the dispensers already changed? Or is this in the process of?
I believe it's in the process of. So last I heard, they were trying to do basically an inventory. They wanted to see what, which kind of goes to show you how, you know, this is such an afterthought in so many ways. And so they were just like, what do we even have on campus? What is full? What is not full? Last I heard, they were still kind of in the process of sussing that out. And I hadn't heard of any issues. So I think it's probably still going pretty smoothly.
In doing the inventory, did you hear any thing about how well stocked they were, if they weren't, because if they weren't sure how many they had, that leads me to wonder how often do you check and how often do you restock?
And I think I made one of the same comments when I heard that. I was like, I did not hear specifically on that, but I will tell you from anecdotally and conversing about this around campus that was one of the people were like, they're never stocked, or if they are stocked, they're super old. I was standing with a group of folks in one of the engineering buildings. She was just like, hold on, grabbed a quarter, went the tampon was so old that it had like it was like the plastic had melted into the cardboard, and she's like, this must be like 15 years old. And so she's like, but that one worked. You never know. She's like, I know the one downstairs does not work. And so, you know, she's like, it's really kind of a, you know, you don't know what you're going to get. It's kind of like rolling the dice. But a lot of them told me, too, is that they don't even bother with the machines. They will prefer to go around and ask people, you know, which some of the statistics show that like 85% of women have gone through that, which, you know, again, as a male, not something I've ever had to deal with. And so I empathize quite a bit with, you know, I mean, the idea of like, if I have to go to the bathroom, like, do I have paper towels today. Do I have a quarter in my pocket? Did I bring my paper towels? Does anyone have paper towels? I need to go to the bathroom right now. I guess I'm just going to have to go home because they have paper towels at home. And so they, you know, but then we started thinking about, you know, graduate students are 40% international. And so international, different customs, different language barriers and things like that. And so if I'm trying to picture myself in a different country and needing to ask a question like that, I think that would be mortifying for some people. So so I did not get any exact numbers on that, but anecdotally, I know that it wasn't a good situation overall.
With installing the new dispensers, or maybe just taking the locks off, I'm not really sure
how
it works.
I wasn't sure how they wanted to do that yet either.
And making sure they are stocked and perhaps better stocked than they have been, is that going to require more funding? Is there some sort of grant or something that people are going
so,
after?
So from my personal perspective, the way I saw it was this was the university's responsibility to pay for. Mm-hmm. Initially, some folks suggested, you know, maybe with some of the funds with ASG and GPSC, we can get this kind of off the ground. And I felt pretty strongly against that because, again, this is something that the university pays for in every other bathroom-related circumstance. And so there's no reason why graduate students should be taking student activity fees that we, again, like I said, we use for things like conferences and research and things like that, and put this towards something that we believe fundamentally the university should be providing. I'm assuming this is a facilities management thing in terms of their line item. So,
okay.
But again, like I said, not my area of expertise. I'm happy to leave
that
to
them. We're still rolling it out and figuring it out.
Exactly.
Has there been any discussion of also offering pads?
I believe there are at least some machines, if not the plan for the other machines, will offer both.
Both. Okay.
And one thing that we have kind of talked about is this was initially sort of more of a long-term goal, but because they basically skipped the whole piloting step. One thing that I did discuss with some of the ASG counterparts was to have a few select locations on campus that provide more of a variety of products. So what you have in every bathroom is something that basically anyone can use if they needed an emergency. And that can get them through if they need to, like I said, go to class, go to a meeting, finish research. But if they want, you know, if they need something to allow them to be more comfortable, if they have different preferences, somewhere like the Union or Pat Walker Health Center to use some of our money to kind of provide a small stock of things like that. And, you know, one of the other things that we're doing as well is as we're working kind of creating our stickers to slap on the machines is we're also wanting to make a point that if you're an individual who needs these particularly because of lack of being able to afford them as opposed to forgetting them, that we have on there that the Gearhart Food Pantry offers these as well. And so to, you know, ensure that, you know, these are here for you to take, please take one. But if this is something that is a financial need, we want to make sure that you also know that the university in their food pantry does offer products like these to give to students.
And they were already offering that.
Yes, they were. Yes, that's correct. Yep. And so one of the issues I've seen with the food pantry and some data that, you know, it's there and it offers a ton, but so few people use it. And so that was one of the big things. I was like, no, let's put that right on the sticker, right in the front to make sure that, you know, that we're pushing that even further because obviously they offer things and provide assistance and a whole bunch of other issues too. So you kind of get to kill two birds with one stone a little bit there.
So the goal is to have this ready for students in the fall is what
it sounds
like.
That's the goal, yeah. The last time we kind of met as a little planning group, we talked about kind of doing something official a couple of weeks after the semester starts, basically let things kind of get started, kind of the bustle of the first few weeks kind of get over with, and then we wanted to do something to put it in the newswire, get it out there, and, you know, publicly have it. We think that it will be up and moving by then, but just in terms of having a little bit of a public rollout. We're hoping to get we're having fun and trying to be creative with some things to hand out in terms of flyers at orientation, maybe even get some buttons. We talked about dubbing ourselves the period ambassadors, which we thought was pretty funny, and just you know, making it out there. And a big part of this and a lot of what you see, I think, in this little bit of a movement is this kind of societal shame people have in talking about menstruation. And like I said, you know, this was something, I mean, you know, being, like I said, a gay man, it's not something that I've had to encounter, but it's also not something anyone ever discusses either. And so that, you know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And in fact, you know, it's sexist. You know what I mean? The fact that this is something that only impacts females. And so, you know, we wanted to ensure that while we're doing this, we're also trying to push that concept as well to make it sure that, you know, it's 2019 now. You know, we regard ourselves as an organization that values diversity, that values the equality of the genders. And so this is something that can really intangibly try to accomplish that.
What else should we know?
If you Google around, this has been happening a ton, a lot more. Even back in March, there was not a lot. There was a I know a handful of schools that had done that. I had gone to actually one of the I forgot to mention, one of my inspirations for this was in January. I had a conference at UT Dallas, and I think we were in their student union, and they had big monitors with, you know, rolling information and stuff like that, and they had a big one that offered, was like basically saying, we offer, you know, free menstruation products, and listed all the places where you could go get them. And I was like, that's it. That's right. Like, that's the kind of thing we want to do. And so that really helped us kind of coalesce and decide to do that. And, you know, I learned just personally in there, I had been referring to them kind of as feminine hygiene products, and just discussing it with some of my counterparts, you know, we realized that, you know, that's not, even that in and of itself, for a couple of reasons, is not really a good term if our goal is complete inclusivity. You know, saying hygiene products in and of itself is going to inherently kind of continue that shame, basically, by, you know, by that word has those types of connotations with it. And then, of course, with feminine, there are some people who menstruate who don't identify as female. And so, you know, that's another big thing for us. And we also are going to, I guess, along those same lines, going to ensure that the gender-neutral bathrooms on campus also have them. I do know that there were some schools that I'd read about that actually put the products in virtually every single bathroom. And while that would be something I think that we would like to look towards kind of in the future once this kind of gets off the ground and we see how things go. But it would be great to ensure that it's not just limited to gender-neutral bathrooms, that if anyone needs to access this type of a product, they can do so in the privacy of any bathroom.
Thank you so much for your time.
This was great. Thank you for having me.
James DiLoretto Hill is president of the Graduate Professional Student Congress at the University of Arkansas. He talked with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda at the Carver Center for Public Radio last week.
What is the Chicxulub Crater? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. The Chicxulub Crater, or better known as the Dinosaur Killer, is a 93-mile diameter crater off the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. This was formed by a large asteroid or comet, quite possibly up to 50 miles in diameter. The crater is dated to be about 66 million years old and has a double ring structure. It's actually Earth's best-preserved double-ring crater. A double-ring crater of an impact means that the ground wavered so much from the severe impact that the ground truly rippled upward. In 2016, a scientific drilling project led by Dr. Joanna Morgan of Imperial College in London drilled deep into the peak ring of that impact crater, hundreds of meters below the current sea floor, to obtain rock core samples from the impact itself. What they found were layers of rock that had been cooked and melted and shattered from the sheer impact. From these core samples, scientists can now have insight to how large impacts have shaped an early Earth surface, changed surrounding terrestrial rocks, and what this means for other crater-dominated planetary surfaces in our solar system. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
Artisphere is a wide-ranging festival centered around the arts and environment curated by Walton Arts Center. By wide-ranging, we mean classical music, classic movies, documentaries, dance, folk music, an inflatable planetarium, a trail walk, chamber music, education, poetry, workshops, art, and theater. It all begins tonight with a performance by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands at Thorn Crown Chapel in Eureka Springs. So let's spend the next 4.5 minutes trying to get a handle on all of this with Megan Dale, Learning and Engagement Coordinator, and Rachel Berkovich, Programming Coordinator at Walton Arts Center. Rachel says every piece of Artisphere is connected to the theme of space.
Because it is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, so everything's space this year.
Well, let's okay, so does that extend into film?
Yes. Yes, we have a whole film series. And for the free film series, I guess the first one is going to be at the end of Trail Mix. We'll be showing WALL-E, and that is going to be in our atrium. It's free, but we do ask that you say that you'll be attending on our website. And then we also have 2001 A Space Odyssey on the 25th, Apollo 13 on the 28th, and E.T. and Close Encounters of the Third Kind on the 29th, and they are all free at the Walton Arts Center.
And then there are other films as well, right?
So we will have
Dwarf Planets included.
Dwarf Planets included. There's a lot of contention about that one, but we made sure Pluto got in there.
Yes.
So along the trail, in addition to the different artists that will be along, the stops will also include the planets where we'll have these big stickers that identify which planet you've made it to and then some fun facts about the planet.
Can you tell me just some of the music that we'll hear on Trail Mix?
Oh, I can tell you all of the music.
Okay.
We've got Rosenbridge. We have Rael. We have Block Street Hot Club, Mom and Pop, Papa Rap, and The Crumbs. And those are all local bands.
Yep.
And we have Mom and Pop and Papa Rap for the kiddos. And the rest will be family friendly, obviously. Then we also have Melrose Poetry Bureau. And there will be a couple of them outside with typewriters. And you give them a theme, and they write a poem right there, live. And then I believe you get a copy to take with you. So that should be pretty cool. That's new. We've never done that before.
And when you say typewriters, you mean?
Typewriters.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not computers.
What people would have been typing on when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon.
Sure, yeah.
What else? There's no way we're going to get everything, but what else should we highlight?
Well, with Trail Mix, we also have Community Creative Center that's going to be doing art activities for kids and families outside of their space, so at the beginning of our solar system. And then at the end of the solar system, we're going to have the Amazium that's going to be doing some different science-themed activities for kids as well.
Now, forgive me for not knowing this exactly. I know in years past there's been Trail Mix in Bentonville and Fayetteville. Same thing this year?
No. But we will be at the Bentonville Farmers Market on the 15th, and there we will have Mom and Pop, Papa Rap, and The Crumbs.
Okay.
And they'll be on the main stage there.
And then Friday the 14th is Trail Mix on the Greenway in Fayetteville.
Correct.
And that's where the solar system is.
Yes, from 5:30 to 7:30. And then following is WALL-E in the atrium, along with a planetarium. And I'll let Megan talk a little bit about that.
So the Space Hogs, which is the student organization at the University of Arkansas, has an inflatable planetarium. So we've asked them to come set that up in Star Theater. And it has different constellations and maps of the solar system so families can go in and explore.
Wow.
In the AC.
Now, I'm reading your sheet upside down that's on my desk, and I see something that says future folk music.
Yes.
What is future folk music?
So Sam Ryder and the Human Hands are our Chapel Series artists, so they're going to be doing concerts in the community at Cooper Chapel and Thorncrown Chapel, but Sam Ryder is an artist that also provides educational outreach to the community, so we are taking him to Springdale Public Library, the Fayetteville Boys and Girls Club, Butterfield Trail Village, and Bentonville Public Library for him to lead this workshop called Future Folk Music. And it's an educational concert that puts American roots music in conversation with major cultural themes of the last century. And it encourages students to consider the important role of music and art in the world of tomorrow.
We haven't even touched on the Artists for Your Orchestra. They're back.
No, yes. We actually have a really amazing finale planned. It's going to involve footage from the moon landing to films about the moon to original artwork that's going to be synced up with the music. It'll have live narration. So it's supposed to be a sort of a voyage, right? Like, so you're in the spaceship and they're taking you on the journey to the moon.
Walton Arts Center's Rachel Berkovich, programming coordinator, and Walton Arts Center's Megan Dale, learning and engagement coordinator, speaking about Artisphere 2019. You can find a complete schedule of events, a map of Trail Mix, and more at waltonartcenter.org, or you can download the free Artisphere app.
Support for 91.3 comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. The latest edition features contractors and subcontractors, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com. The 12th annual Art in the Garden at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks is Friday, June 21st at 6 p.m. This summer event includes an art display and sale curated by Art Ventures NWA, plus live music, food, wine, craft beer, and margaritas. Proceeds support the Botanical Garden's educational programs and services. Tickets are limited. bgozarks.org for tickets and more information.
It's Monday. It's the ninth day of June 2019. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is the features editor of the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, Becca Martin Brown.
I think there should be a disclosure on this. I'm going to talk about trout fishing in America.
What would be the full disclosure on that?
I love trout fishing in America.
You can't be completely unbiased.
I can't even be a little bit unbiased because my daughter thinks they're Elvis, the Beatles, and National Park Radio.
So do a lot of people.
They're celebrating 40 years this year. Keith played classical bass for the Houston Symphony. They were on strike.
Yeah.
He needed to make some money. He met Ezra, who was a garage band guitar player. They started playing music together. They went out to California. They were busking on the streets in California, trying to make enough money to get home.
Right.
Here we are 40 years later. They've got grown children. Keith has grandchildren, adults with mortgages, and they still like each other, and they're still making music. So in honor of 40 years, they're doing some things.
Good.
Number one, they have a new live CD out. It's called Live at the Epic Theater and was recorded in Grand Prairie, Texas. And it's the perfect example of the thing that's kind of changing in their 40th year. Mm-hmm. It includes tracks like Where's Your Mama, which is this great, funny, laughing lament about being middle-aged, When I Was a Dinosaur, which is a kid's classic, and The Strangest Times, which is one of the old songs that has popped back up as they've looked back over their catalog of music. The plan is by the end of this year to have a 40th anniversary, maybe double CD.
Perfect.
With favorite things. They say the one thing they're going to give up this year is separating kids' stuff and adult stuff.
Okay.
So we'll get to hear more mixed concerts, which I think is great. And if you want to go check them out, because God forbid, perhaps you've never seen trout fishing in America. They're playing at 6:30 on Tuesday at the Botanical Garden in Fayetteville as part of the Artisphere Festival.
That'll be a fun time.
The concert is free. Here's the caveat. You need to reserve tickets at waltonartcenter.org/artisphere. And here's why. If it rains, please God let it rain because they have air conditioning. They'll move it to the Walton Arts Center.
Okay. Oh, but then there's only 1,200.
Then there's only 1,200 seats.
Gotcha.
So you need 1,201, actually. So you need to have a ticket. So get yourself a ticket. Get yourself to the Botanical Garden. Bring your kids. Bring grandma and grandpa. Bring everybody. They'll have a good time. Also this week, and also on Tuesday, so sorry, the Fort Smith Main Library is hosting an evening with Jennifer Farr Davis. She's an athlete, an author, and a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year. Mm. And she's speaking at 7 o'clock. It's free, but they'll have her books for sale. On Wednesday, the Fayetteville Public Library is hosting Monkey See, Monkey Do.
Yes, from the Opera in the Ozarks, folks.
This is their children's outreach performance for the year. That's at 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock. The Five and Dime series at the Walmart Museum in Bentonville is Wednesday with the UA faculty trio at 6 o'clock. And then on Thursday, it's Gully Park Concert Series.
Wow.
I'm going to mess up his name. Devin Gilfillian?
Yes.
At 7 o'clock. Yes. That's free. Again, if you've never been, really, go.
That's a lot of cool free stuff for 1 week.
Yeah. I'm thinking about reinstituting. We used to have three. We used to have a music calendar, an adult calendar, and a kids calendar. I'm thinking about reintroducing the kids' calendar for the summer.
Introduce the free calendar.
Yeah.
You know, everything that's on that
calendar
is free.
Maybe it's $5 and under or something.
Yeah. The cheap date calendar.
Cheap date calendar, because it's crazy how much free stuff there is.
Becca Martin Brown is the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
My name is Nancy Padilla of Springdale. I am a Spanish teacher, and I like listening to the talk shows because all the wonderful topics. Muchas gracias por la excelente programación. And you are listening to KUAF 91.3.
Not everybody wants to go to the dentist. Some people really don't want to go. As Ann Kenda with Arkansas Public Media reports, there can be reasons behind a fear of dental visits and ways to help with that fear.
It's a busy day at Higginbotham Family Dental in Jonesboro, with patients getting their teeth cleaned, cavities filled, and crowns placed. Most are ordinary appointments, but patients who are fearful or have low tolerance for pain also have the option of relaxation medications or conscious sedation.
Well, the last numbers that I have seen was that 20% of the population is too scared to go to the dentist. So sometimes people's biggest deal is just walking through the door.
That's Dr. Todd Higginbotham, one of a growing number of dentists in Arkansas who practice sedation dentistry. He says dental fear tends to have roots in the past.
Almost every one of them will link a bad event when they were a child. Almost every one of them is linked with some kind of event where a dentist hurt them as a child, or they were held down, or even later in life where they just hurt and maybe the provider couldn't stop or didn't stop, and it just stressed them out to a point, and now it's built up in their head so much that they're just extremely fearful.
Higginbotham treats some patients with sedation medications that keep them relaxed, yet awake enough to hear and respond. They have to be driven home by a family member or friend who monitors them for the rest of the day. Dr. Gregory Ness, a professor of oral surgery at The Ohio State University College of Dentistry, says it's a well-established phenomenon that people who experience dental sedation later become more comfortable and may decide that they can do without sedation next time.
Over time, people gradually realize that, you know, their dentist is really more than capable of making their visit comfortable and, in most cases, virtually pain-free. And a lot of times they go from being that extremely fearful, anxious, distrustful place to being able to walk in, sit down, and get dental work done.
Ness says fear is common, but not the only reason for sedation. Patients with conditions such as autism, Down syndrome, or Parkinson's disease, for example, may not be able to sit through an appointment without some sedation. Because there's always risks associated with any sedating drug, Ness says such medications may not be appropriate for every patient or for all dentists to administer.
I think the people who are really particularly patient and caring and can project that well tend to be able to manage the intermediate difficulty cases without sedation. I think the people who are going to do sedation need to be the sort of the top of the class, super detail-oriented, aware of not just dental but medical conditions, and those people are the ones you want to be using what are really, you know, dangerous drugs in the wrong hands.
Dr. Higginbotham says sedation dentistry has come a long way in the 10 years or so that he's been practicing it.
And so this was a new thing back years ago, and so we did it, and since then there's been thousands of cases done with it, and it's such a safe procedure with such safe medications. I mean, we have reversal agents. So if someone was to get a little bit oversedated, we can reverse the medication if we need to. So just to be able to help more people, I think that's the key.
In Jonesboro, Ann Kenda, Arkansas Public Media.
Support for this series on oral health in Arkansas comes from the Delta Dental of Arkansas Foundation, working to increase access to dental care in the state and improve the oral health of all Arkansans.
Another national championship trophy for the Arkansas Razorback women's track program. This weekend, the Razorbacks claimed the NCAA championship in Austin, Texas, finishing 7 points ahead of national runner-up USC. Arkansas women also won the indoor national championship earlier this year. This weekend's work gives Arkansas women 4 national titles in program history and now 45 track and field and cross-country championships between the Arkansas women's and men's programs. The men, by the way, this weekend finished tied for 15th in Austin. The Razorback baseball team still seeking a return trip to the College World Series in Omaha. To take that trip, Arkansas has to defeat Mississippi this afternoon at 3 at Baum Stadium. The teams have split the first two games of the best of three Super Regional. Today's winner would face Florida State in the first round of the College World Series this weekend. Today's game is sold out, but will be shown on ESPN2. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, rules to regulate pollution trading credits for farms, businesses, and public utilities in Arkansas are under scrutiny.
And this regulation, I believe, is really open to abuse.
That's tomorrow at noon and 7 on Ozarks at Large on 91.3. 91.3 has been with you every day this year, bringing you the news you rely on, the music you love, and the conversations that keep you glued to the radio. Now, we're approaching the end of our financial year, June 30th, and we're raising funds to keep KUAF stronger than ever. Your gift before June 30th helps us toward our goal of $30,000 for the month, and when you give, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to a generous anonymous donor. Support your public radio station today and help us end our financial year as strong as ever. You can give online at supportkuaf.com, and thank you.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
Some folks say that Willie Green was the baddest motherfucker the world ever seen. But I want you to hold on to your seat. Hold on to them tight. Cause you now get ready to see the story of me. Yes, me, the badass.
Ray Moore was born March 17, 1937, in Fort Smith, although the year is in some question. He and his family also lived in Paris and Logan County. Moore sold snacks to servicemen at Fort Chaffee for extra money before he hit the traveling variety show circuit. After a while, he was emceeing the shows, wearing a turban with his stage name, Prince Du Mar. Comedians, flash dancers, musicians, and other types of acts appeared in the shows, and Moore would assimilate it all into what became his own act. Musically influenced by the likes of fellow Arkansas-er Louis Jordan, Moore danced and sang and always wanted to be an R&B singer himself. He continued singing and began concentrating on comedy after he got drafted in the early 1950s for the Korean War. By the late 1960s, Rudy Ray Moore had released several comedy albums, but really found success with Dolomite. Moore appropriated Dolomite from a routine a homeless man did, who performed a ribald rhyming toast in Hollywood for spare change. How bad was Dolomite? By the age of one, he was drinking whiskey and gin. By the age of two, he was eating the bottles it came in. Outrageous in every way, especially sexually, the tale of Dolomite follows the tall tale tradition found in African-American communities as well as European communities in the Ozarks. Moore debuted his Dolomite routine on his album Eat Out More Often. Other popular comedy albums by Moore, full of profane braggadocio, followed in its wake. Rudy Ray Moore was now on his way to becoming known in the 21st century as one of the forefathers of rap and one of the most sampled artists ever.
I'm going back to the flatland.
Rudy Ray Moore's albums and constant touring helped solidify both Moore and his newfound alter ego, Dolomite. Meanwhile, in the early 1970s, so-called blaxploitation films targeting urban audiences had struck box office gold in America. Shaft and Superfly were probably the most popular and helped set the standard. Car chases, sex, funky music, and deals gone sour, usually through the hands of a corrupt white power elite. And although at their worst, many of these films played on easy stereotypes, they did often feature African Americans in often rare, strong leading roles. Enter Dolomite. Not only does the rhyming routine play on stereotypes, it makes Dolomite out to be a man so tough, he got a job in Africa kicking lions in the ass just to stay in shape. And so lascivious, he was run out of South America for having relations with steers. In short, Dolomite may have been the best pedigreed blaxploitation hero ever.
This is Rudy Ray Moore, better known as Dolomite. I've got an all-girl army that knows what to do. They're fox as hell and practice kung fu. From the first to the last, I give them the blast so fast that their life is passed before they has even hit the grass. Dolomite.
However, the blaxploitation genre had peaked by the mid-1970s as Moore began gathering financing for a Dolomite movie. Moore spent a year on the road and got an advance from his record distributor to put together more than $100,000 himself. It wasn't very much for a motion picture, even in 1970s dollars. The Dolomite soundtrack, which we've been hearing on this episode, did not take up very much of the already meager budget. The musicians hired were given the name the Soul Rebellion Orchestra for purposes of the movie. Future Grammy winner James Ingram plays on the soundtrack, as well as appearing in the film. In the 1980s and 1990s, he'd become known for his own hits, as well as duets with Michael McDonald, Linda Ronstadt, and Dolly Parton. The sessions were recorded at Ted Brinson's Los Angeles, California studios. Brinson is best known for recording the enduring doo-wop hit Earth Angel, which hit number one in 1954. In fact, it's a song which has its own Arkansas connections, being co-written by doo-wop pioneer Jesse Belvin.
I'm going to let them know that Dolemite is back on the scene.
A shooting schedule of 6 weeks was set for the film debut of Dolemite. The director was Derville Martin. Although the actor was making his directorial debut, Martin had been in a hit mainstream film, 1968's Rosemary's Baby, and in several blaxploitation films, such as Hell Up in Harlem and Black Caesar. In addition to directing Dolemite, Martin was to play the villain, Willie Green.
Uptown, downtown, crowned and renowned. I put my finger in the ground and turned the whole world around. Dolemite, starring me, Rudy Ray Moore, as Dolemite, and that bad Derville Martin as Willie Green.
No less than City Hall is behind Green and his crime and drug dealing. But can they be any match for Dolemite with his all-girl army of kung fu killers? Surely not. Here in its entirety, from the Dolemite soundtrack, is the instrumental The Jive Jungle by the Soul Rebellion Orchestra. The Jive Jungle, from the Dolemite movie soundtrack, by the Soul Rebellion Orchestra, from Rudy Ray Moore of Sebastian and Logan Counties. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook, with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
And contributors to this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large included Susanna Sitek and Antoinette Grajeda. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. Big thanks to Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette for her help today. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto manager at the University of Arkansas, and it is produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at KUAF. And Kenda's reporting on oral health in Arkansas is a product of Arkansas Public Media. And our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can learn more about Daryl at darylshawn.com, his latest CD titled Safe in Sound. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF, and this is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, KUAF 91.3, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Lamar. You can listen to us when you'd like if you subscribe to the free Ozarks at Large podcast. It's available through services like Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. You can also share individual stories and interviews that you hear on our program through social media and email by looking for the links at ozarksatlarge.com. We'll be back tomorrow at noon and 7 on KUAF with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Don't forget, we are trying to raise $30,000. By the end of our fiscal year, which is June 30th, you can help us out by giving in the amount of your choice right now at supportkuaf.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your Monday.